Danger's my middle name.
Mine's Cornelius. Don't tell anybody I kill you.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Everybody, it's that time again, so be prepared, because Junk Food Cinema is coming at you again, and we are firing on all cylinders, and we are emptying every clip this week. This is, of course, the weekly cult and exploitation podcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening, and we are here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. We are also here on SoundCloud. We are also here on FilmSchoolRejects.com's new host, Medium.com. So lots of cool stuff going on. We're everywhere. We're all over the stratosphere. We're in pieces.
We're on iTunes. We're on Stitcher.
We're on Twitter.
We're in a garage converted into a den.
Yeah, we are in tiny little chunks all over the place, just like Taylor Negron. We will get to that in just a moment, folks. But first,
Do not speak ill of Taylor Negron.
Well, if you... I hope to take a little piece of him with me everywhere I go. And if this movie has anything to say about it, that's a possibility. I am Fuckface, and he is Asshole, otherwise known as Brian, and Cargill, Lieutenant of Megaforce.
Hi.
And we are here to host another episode of Junk Food Cinema. As we mentioned, you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Well, last week we talked about a movie in which a basketball player is dragged down to the depths of hell to play basketball with the Looney Tunes against aliens from another planet. This week's movie is also vaguely sports themed, in that it is a movie that opens and closes during a football game. But it also has an added apropos quality this week, as Shane Black's The Nice Guys is hitting theaters. We are talking about a film from 1991 written by Monsieur Shane Black and directed by none other than Tony Scott.
Tony Scott!
Tony Scott. It is a film that I think is very unfairly overlooked in the oeuvre of both of those two guys. I'm, of course, talking about The Last Boy Scout.
We're going to a ball game.
They've got one shot.
What am I going to do?
Point at the bad guys and shoot!
To get the goods.
Ah!
I'm the bad guys.
Just once, I would like to hear you scream.
Play some rap music.
Out of ideas, man. Take your best shot.
If they don't kill each other first. Bruce Willis. Damon Wayans. The Last Boy Scout.
Yeah, God, I was so happy when you emailed me to talk about this movie. You know, two of my deep-fried favorite filmmakers are, of course, Shane Black, who has, you know, The Nice Guys coming out this week. Back in his days as a, you know, the most wanted screenwriter in the world. Like, this was one of those big sales that propelled him into the stratosphere. And, of course, as we've talked about many times on the show, one of my favorite directors of all time and criminally underrated directors, Tony Scott. And this movie is really great. And revisiting it, every time I rewatch this film, I'm reminded that how breathless a film it is. Like, this film is a movie that just takes off and just starts running and drags you along with it. And there's all of the setup feels natural. Like, shit just keeps happening, and it's all big shit. And it is a perfect example of what would become a classic Shane Black story. Like, you know, Shane Black has written a number of different films, but he has one prevailing story type. He tells the classic story of essentially noir detectives in some way, shape, or form. It's Shane's obsession is that era and that kind of genre, where you have someone like Carpenter who... it was essentially influenced by Westerns, Shane, and was constantly ripping them off. Shane Black was influenced by noir detective stories. And that's what this is it's a noir detective story with all of the accoutrements of big 80s action mixed with what was working at the time. It's a buddy story, but it's not a cop film. Mm-hmm. And it's got a guy who is known as a comedian in a much more serious role. And then, you know, this big, huge action star at the time and Bruce Willis team together. And then Shane just does what he does, which is he takes a tried and true formula and then he completely turns it on its ear and tells the story in ways that you're like, I've never seen this before. Holy shit, I've never seen this before. And then, of course, you have someone like Ridley Scott, who is just a master at making films look slick. This movie looks...
Tony Scott. You said Ridley.
I said Ridley, and I shouldn't. Tony Scott. Because every... You know, there's that running thing where... Everybody for a long time has considered Tony the lesser talented brother, and I would argue that Tony was the more consistent brother.
I would argue that entirely.
His movies,
especially now,
his movies are consistently entertaining and hold up.
Yeah,
so much better than many of Ridley's films did.
That's true.
This movie just looks slick, and it looks good, and it still looks modern. Here, this movie is 25 years old right now. Action movies today struggle to look like this.
Absolutely.
You know, just the you know, his obsession with large wide lenses and his great 300mm lens shots and just crazy shit that he would do that just looks so slick that inspired other people to do it. And this movie is the prototype for the type of action movie we have now. It is so fucking good. And there's not a single moment in this film that you have to forgive. Like, a lot of times we're like, okay, yeah, this isn't great and this could be better, but this is why this is awesome. This movie's perfect.
We often acknowledge the yellow dye number 5 in the snack cakes that we passionately love to consume. But with this film, yeah, I think all the ingredients really work, and I think there isn't a lot to apologize for.
I don't think there's anything to apologize
for. And Shane Black is, he is a marvel. And I don't just mean because he directed Iron Man 3. I mean because he sold the script for Lethal Weapon, which is one of the greatest action scripts ever written.
Yep.
When he was in his early fucking 20s. Like, that is insane to me. And then he goes on to take that formula and do so many interesting different things with it. But it's funny to me revisiting this movie and realizing if you really look at the DNA of a Shane Black script, you start to understand why that Iron Man 3 is absolutely his Iron Man 3. Even if you don't realize it at the time. You mentioned the sort of buddy cop thing. I actually started to refer to Shane Black scripts as cruddy cop movies. Because you have two people paired up that don't necessarily get along, but they're also two people who are usually completely broken and at the end of their ropes.
Well, and that's because that's what's so interesting about Shane is,
and that's the pulp side of him for sure.
Yeah, yeah, he's every single one of his movies, his characters are rich and different, and he does something different every time. That's the thing is he uses this same conceptual structure. Like, you can identify, you can take any of his films and easily go, okay, so structurally, this is a Chandler story.
Yeah.
But how he gets into everyone is different.
Yeah.
How he pairs up the characters in each one is different. And the concepts of those characters are different every time. Even when you have characters that are kind of similar, like Riggs and...
Murtaugh.
Well, no. The character of Riggs in Lethal Weapon is very similar to
Bruce Willis's character in this.
And Hollenbeck. They're very similar in that they're these self-hating guys with just these really broken lives. But why they're broken is radically different.
Yeah.
And why they hate themselves is different. And ultimately where they come from and who they are is different. And there's no one character that of his main characters that is ever like any other main character in any of the movies, even if they're broken. And he's not afraid to throw broken characters together.
He writes
such snappy, funny fucking shit.
Oh, his dialogue just like, even I will say this because I think I'm allowed to at this point. The Nice Guys is fantastic.
Oh, I have not seen it yet.
It is utterly fantastic. And a lot of the reason it's so fantastic is because of that dialogue just does not let up. It is so It's so funny and so sharp and so engaging that there are certain elements of the story of The Nice Guys that I think I'm forgiving that could have been stronger that don't bother me as much because I'm just so enthralled by the back and forth play between Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling. And I you know, speaking of the different ways he gets into things, I want to do something a little bit different for this episode that we don't do a lot, but I think would really serve us on this one, where
Tango
Cash. I want to go through the plot of the movie, just start to finish. We're just going to go through the plot of this movie, and we're going to basically stop whenever we hit upon something we want to talk about in the film. But because we're talking about a detective story, because we're talking about, you know, intricate crime mysteries, which is something that Shane Black puts together very well, I think we'd be better served just kind of going through the plot step by step. So this movie starts off at the halftime of a Friday night football game, which, by the way, is not a real thing in the NFL, but they couldn't get the rights to Hank Williams' Are You Ready for Some Football, which was the Monday night football theme.
So they parody it.
So they parody it, and they make it Friday night football.
Friday night's a good night for football.
And you have the star running back played by Billy Cole, played by Billy Blanks. Oh yeah, Tybo Maestro, Billy Blanks himself.
Oh, yeah.
Who gets a phone call during halftime by someone named Milo, who says, you know, you have to win this game at all costs because there's a lot riding on it. So he goes out there. He's obviously been rattled by this call.
By the way, comedy fans and cult film fans will recognize
Friends of
the
that
voice.
One episode of Friends.
Yes, sure. But you're going to recognize the voice right away. You're going to be like, that's Taylor Negrin. That's the voice of the guy that go, did anybody order a pizza? who, by the way, famously came all the way to Austin for a screening of Fast Time at Ridgemont High so they could pull a Tim League special. This is just one of the greatest things ever to happen at the Alamo. They're showing Fast Times at Ridgemont High. They get to the point right where there's a knock on the door and the film burns.
Oh.
And burns out. And everyone's like, oh.
I can already kind of guess where this
is
going.
And then Taylor Negrin walks out on stage with a pizza and goes, did anybody order a pizza? And the crowd goes nuts. They serve pizza to people. Everybody gets pizza in the audience. And then
it's a film geek rim shot.
Yeah, they then start the movie back up. And then Taylor Negrin does a small Q&A at the end. But you recognize his voice right away. And this is easily his best performance in a film.
I would agree with that.
He is genuinely menacing in this movie.
And it's funny when you see him in something like Nothing But Trouble, which I don't recommend you watch Nothing But Trouble, but if you happen to have already seen Nothing But Trouble, for more than just Tupac's cameo as a dancer for Digital Underground, that's right, bitches.
Oh, yeah.
You may remember, like, you may not think of him as somebody who can play menacing, but he definitely pulls it off in this movie.
Well, in one of my cult favorites that I just revisited, I actually quote regularly. I love this movie. We have not talked about it. We probably should at some point. It's called The Stoned Age.
Take a drink.
Here we go.
Yep, we're actually drinking tonight.
Taylor Negrin actually appears for a minute and a half as a clerk at a alcohol shop, whatever.
A liquor store?
A liquor store, whatever your name for it is.
Did that sip of beer take away the words liquor store from your brain?
It killed the brain cells for it that contained the word liquor store.
Alanis, I think I have your next verse because that is some ironic shit.
So, he plays a liquor store clerk and is hilarious in it because it's kind of loosely set in the 70s and he's hilarious. But I love him and he is so great here. So you hear this voice, but you're like, that's Taylor Negrin, but it's brooding, menacing Taylor Negrin.
Yeah.
So he calls, he says, you better start scoring some points.
Or your history.
And
so Billy Blanks takes a whole bunch of PCP and in his frazzled state and the drug-addledness of his brain, as he's running for the end zone, there's one last defender in his way, pulls a gun out of his waistband and just starts shooting all the defenders left and it's between him and the end zone, which is it takes the scene to like horrifying new levels.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, he just like kneels down and utters the classic line from this movie, which is, ain't life a bitch, and he shoots himself in the head. Which, since it was Billy Blanks, I expected him to go double time and get two shots off, but apparently just the one did it. Cut to private investigator Joe Hallenbeck, who is to say down on his luck, he's sleeping in a car at the beginning of this movie.
Well, that's the thing is, this is classic Shane Black. You're given the impression that he's down on his luck. He's not. He's not down on his luck at all. He just fucking hates himself and is such a fucking dick that he just kind of is fucked his life into oblivion. Yeah. He's not down on his luck. He's not waiting for his ship to come in. He's kind of fucked himself because he's so in such a dark place.
He's in a bad place, maybe, is how I should have put it. I mean, this was a period of time in which Bruce Willis could still play heroes who were borderline reprehensible fuck-ups.
Well, but that's the thing, is that this movie presents it like the classic he's down on his luck. Like, he just needs the right case.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, no. No, as you go on and on, you find out that this guy is a fucking superhero who fucked up bad and is so angry with himself and so angry at life and so angry with this invisible villain that his entire life is crumbled. He's disconnected with his family. He and his daughter fucking hate each other.
Yeah.
He is just a fucking mess, but a wonderful three-dimensional mess that, as you presented him, is exactly how Shane presents him at the beginning, exactly how Tony Scott presents him at the beginning.
Yeah.
Is, oh, this is a down on his luck guy. And as you get into it, you start realizing, oh no.
Well, but it goes full circle because you think he's down on his luck and then you start to realize what a giant fuck up he is. Which, again, in this period of time, I love the Bruce Willis characters, you know, that he's taking on. Even his John McClane in this era, which would be Die Hard with a Vengeance a couple years later, is...
Well, when this came out, right after this, was Die Hard 2.
Right, but then when in Die Hard 3, shortly thereafter, that John McClane is like a drunk who's on suspension, who they literally have to like drag out of his apartment when he has a hangover.
Yeah.
Like, that's my favorite Bruce Willis.
Oh, yeah.
When he's playing heroes who are still just like... broken and like complete and utter fuck ups, and you don't even know if you can really trust him. So then we get into why all the reasons he's fucked up, and then by the end of the movie we come full circle and understand that this is a character who keeps getting in his own way because of his fucking moral code.
Yes,
he's got like this quiet drunken Irish Bushido going on,
hence the title of the film, The Last Boy Scout,
which is very subtly like plays only in two scenes in the whole movie. And one of them, if you blink, you'll miss it.
Yes.
But we'll get to that in just a moment. So coming right into the movie, he's fucked with by some neighborhood kids. And then he finds out that his wife, he gets an assignment from his business associate, Mike.
From his buddy.
From his buddy, Mike, and who to protect this stripper played by
Halle Berry.
Halle Berry in a very brief role in this film. And then as soon as he accepts the job, he comes to find out that his buddy Mike is also sleeping with his wife, and she's doing it apparently just to get his attention because he's completely distant, and he doesn't even really faze him all that much. He's just like...
He's so disconnected and so angry. And
His rage amounts to him going up to Mike saying, yeah, I'll still take the case. By the way, gut or face?
Head or gut?
Head or gut. And he says, gut, and just punches him once, and that's it.
And that's it. It's over.
That's the extent of his rage. And his wife actually gets onto him, like, why don't you, like, spit on me or scream or do something?
And that's the beauty of this character, and what is so richly drawn about it is that as it goes on, like, there's this scene a little later when he's discussing all this shit that we come to find out in the plot that Mike has slept with his wife and then set him up to take the fall and potentially get killed. And even then... Hollenbeck can't bring himself to be angry at Mike. He's just mad at himself for letting it happen.
Yeah.
Like that is so fucking great. But it never gets so maudlin as to do that. Someone else has to bring our attention to it that it's like, oh shit.
Yeah.
That's just great. And it's so smart. And Hollenbeck is just such an interesting guy. Just this interaction with this character who, as you are about to explain, dies right after head or gut.
He gets into his car and boom, the car explodes. Somebody had planted a bomb in Mike's car.
And the echoes of Mike continue through this film all the way to the end.
Yeah. So cut to the bar where the stripper named Corey, played by Halle Berry, is working. And she has a boyfriend whose name is Jimmy Dix, who is played by Damon Wayans in one of the most interesting pieces of casting, I think, in any buddy cop, cruddy cop, buddy film. like this, Damon Wayans, who, especially at this time, I mean, is really known for a comedy and Living Color, things like that, is playing this former L.A. Stallions, which is the fictional L.A. football team, which I think is funny that now this is the first season. As we're talking about this movie, this upcoming NFL season is the first year where there's going to be a football team in L.A. again.
They call them the Stallions?
No, they did not. The Rams are just moving out there. They're moving back out there. So it's going to be the L.A. Rams again for now. Maybe they'll change to the Stallions. We'll see. But he's a former quarterback who was banned from the league because of gambling charges and also allegations that he abused drugs.
He's essentially Pete Rose, which had just happened.
He's Pete Rose and Daryl Strawberry kind of combined into one character.
No, and this is what's another interesting thing about this movie that fascinates me is that this movie is what you have to understand culturally is this movie's coming on the heels of the death of baseball. You know, when I was a kid, you know, we talked about this last week in the sports thing. Basketball, as I talked about, became a thing of mine, you know, as I followed the Spurs and Sean Elliott and Steve Kerr. Before that, I was really big into baseball, and baseball broke my heart. Between the ages of 8 and 11, it was all baseball all the time. I was collecting baseball cards. I was going to baseball games. Me and my dad would travel and see. I've seen half the teams play. Half the teams at the time, rather. And it was heartbreaking when all this gambling and drug stuff all started happening at once.
Right.
And then the strike happened. And it was just heartbreaking. Yeah. And all of a sudden, the sport was exposed, not as this national pastime, but as just another... just another thing to market to us, just another property, just another product.
Right.
And that these guys were being chewed up and spit out to sell this product to us. And it was one of those times where America just woke up, and baseball never really recovered from it. Hockey did, the NBA did, the NFL did. Baseball never fully recovered in the way that, you know, and got back to where it was pre-80s. But when this happened, all of this was bubbling to the surface and was something everyone was thinking about. And Shane Black then funneled this and used the NFL in place of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, because you have to remember the Pete Rose scandal broke in Sports Illustrated in March of 1989. This movie comes out in 1991.
Yeah.
So obviously it caused a major reaction within Shane. I absolutely think. And it's funny, too, because there's a lot of movies around this era about... There's a lot of movies in the 90s about kind of crazy things happening at sporting events. We have this film I can think of in particular, also The Fan with Robert De Niro and Wesley Snipes, A Face Off, Jean-Claude Van Damme's movie at a hockey game, like all these action
movies.
That's
not Face Off.
Sudden Death. I keep wanting to call Sudden Death Face Off because that's an actual fucking hockey term.
This is the era where Coliseum suddenly got bigger.
Yeah.
And where they were huge and where attendance was big and you know, television had completely inserted itself into everyone's lives. The baby boomers grew up with it and every household had a television and everyone was watching the games. And this was huge. And so the idea of something big and spectacular and violent happening in front of everyone was a big deal. And it was something that, you know, that was a concern that made sense. So all of this from what's going on in this era is what Shane drew on and then put onto football instead of baseball and gave us this plot that was all about the death of modern sports.
You can't really come up with a better literal representation of the death of sports than a star running back committing suicide in the middle of a game.
Oh, like, yeah.
That is...
Oh, and...
Wow.
For those of you young...
That's not a kosher fist bump because that's some ham-fisted stuff, but
okay.
It works really well.
Yeah, so this is... For those of you aspiring screenwriters out there, one of the things you need to do is you need to download this script. It's available on a number of the script sites, and it's out there. This opening sequence we're talking about is something they actually teach in college courses. The way Shane wrote this sequence, the way he makes the football game pop, he uses all of these two-word sentences to make the tension just so tight, and the way you read it. And when you're reading a football game on the page, you are riveted to this opening right from the get-go. There's a reason this script sold for as much as it did. Download this script and read this script, because this script is a perfect example of this is how you write action scenes.
By the way, Shane Black with this movie became the first writer to sell a spec script for $1 million.
Which he would then, with his next script, Long Kiss Goodnight, sell for $4 million.
And it's funny, he held the record for the most money paid for a spec script for 67 days until Joe Esterhaus sold Basic Instinct for $3 million 67 days later. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty interesting, actually.
Which then he then took back for the $4 million.
Well, and it's funny, too, because Shane had the opportunity to make $2.25 million for this script if he had sold to Carol Co., but decided he would rather stick with the lower but still record-setting bid of, you know, $1.75 million to work with Joel Silver, because Joel Silver is the one who produced Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
So I think that sense of loyalty kind of...
And that sense of loyalty paid off, because when Shane had a situation where personal stuff happened and he went into a dark place, and he worked as a script doctor for years but hadn't sold a script or gotten hired onto a script in years, and he sat down and wrote this very personal story that he wanted to direct called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and Joel said absolutely, and Joel used all the juice that he had gotten off the Matrix movies to go ahead and make this $15 million movie without any studio interference at all. So they got their $15 million, and Shane went and proved that he's a fucking badass director as well as a writer. And so that loyalty that he gave, that $500,000 that he passed on in 91, paid off in 2006 as we got Shane Black the director.
See, and it all worked out well for Shane Black in the future. What I find interesting about that is that this film had so much strife behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah.
So much turmoil going on. And a lot of it is because Joel Silver is a great producer, but is also someone who is kind of notorious for being kind of a dickbag.
So notorious that he had a 30-picture deal with Warner Brothers that they got so sick of his shit, they just bought it out.
That's incredible.
They bought it out, said, here's your money, go away, we're not making your movies anymore, eventually.
And such a dick that Tony Scott would later write a character, or would, excuse me, cast an actor who looked like Joel Silver to play Donnie Donowitz, or the Donowitz producer in True Romance.
Yeah.
They cast an actor to look like Joel Silver and had him act like he said Joel Silver was behind the scenes. So that character of Lee Donowitz in True Romance is apparently based on Joel Silver.
Of all the stories I've heard from the number of people I've talked to that have worked with Silver, that would all seem to be true. My favorite story, I'll share this story. My favorite story I've ever heard, I cannot verify that it's true, but I believe the source that it came from. But apparently Joel Silver was dating a girl and essentially told her, hey, I'm going to put you in my next movie. And so, you know, he's dating this beautiful, gorgeous, amazing young actress and promises to put her in his next movie. And he does. And you all know who she is, because everyone listening to this can draw her from memory. She is the girl who runs out half naked from the office in Die Hard. When the terrorists first run in, the girl getting fucked on the desk, that's the role that Joel Silver gave to his girlfriend.
Hilariously, here's what I thought the end of the story was going to be. He didn't do it. They broke up. She got so depressed, she jumped off a hotel balcony while naked. Lethal Weapon.
No, she's...
No, the other terrible chick story in a Joel Silver movie. Okay, yes. Yeah. All right, got it. As if there's only two women with their tits out in any Joel Silver-produced film. Anywho, one of the things I find really interesting in terms of this show is that there's a lot of parallels between what was going on behind the scenes with this film and what was going on behind the scenes of Tango and Cash.
Tango?
Cash. Joel Silver actually said that making this film was one of the three worst experiences of his life. I'm guessing number two is when office fuck girl from Die Hard broke up with him. But apparently Tony Scott said that the production was completely miserable because Silver and Bruce Willis took over the production, which actually mirrors what happened on Tango and Cash. Because
Tango?
Cash. Because Bruce Willis and Sylvester Stallone are both also giant notorious dickbags with miles and miles of stories about how they thought they were bigger than the movies that they were in and tried to take them over no matter who the director was. And so I completely buy the story. And what's the craziest part of all this is that the same guy that was brought in as the fucking Hail Mary pass, and I know that's appropriate considering the opening of Last Boy Scout, the Hail Mary pass for both Tango and Cash and Last Boy Scout, Stuart Baird, the editor, was brought in at the 11th hour for both films to try and salvage them because Joel and Bruce were, he took over production and started altering Shane Black's script. They made him shoot scenes he hated under threat of being fired and having to forfeit his salary. So there's a lot of like, not only that, but Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans apparently hated each other, which I feel like jump forward a couple of decades and with the whole cop-out situation, you're like, oh, yeah, they probably didn't get along either. I believe that as well. Like, there's so much about this movie and what happened on Tango and Cash that's just very, very eerily similar. But that's
and all that chemistry oddly works.
And it's like, somehow that's the thing. Yeah.
Like the idea
what comes out of it is still a success somehow.
Like the idea that like while it makes you sad to think that lead actors hate each other in a film, what really works in this is the fact that that hatred kind of comes through in the performances. Like these characters really genuinely feel like they hate each other for a while until they just like deal with each other.
Right.
Like if there's anything in the movie that I don't buy as much, it's the what happens at the very end in the last scene. The idea that they want to work together and be detectives. Like up until that point, everything else about their hatred and dislike for each other comes through in the best way. When you feel like they're connecting, they connect. Mm-hmm. When they feel like they hate each other, you feel like they really want to knock the fuck out of each other. Like just knock each other the fuck out. Just straight up. And that probably was genuine. And they were probably drawing on that emotion of, I don't like you. Well, I don't like you. And the stories I've heard about both of them would make that seem to be true, would sound true. Although I have heard lots of great things about Damon Wayans. So, but
his son's really good on New Girl. So there's that. So we,
I actually have a friend who used to be his tenant and had nothing but nice things to say about him. Which is very odd. It's like, oh yeah, no, he's great.
Well, that's interesting.
But I have no idea, but they were both like competing stars at the time. Like they were both just blowing up. It's hard to think, you know, there was a time where Bruce Willis and Damon Wayans were two of the biggest box office draws, mm-hmm. but there was a time where they were, and this movie was right at that zenith.
Because there was a time is a recurring line of dialogue for Bruce Willis in the movie Lucky Number 7 that I know most people don't like, but I really love.
So, you named a dog after that movie.
I did name a dog after that movie, Sleven Kalevra.
I love Sleven.
He's a good dog.
He's a good dog.
So all this, we're still in the beginning of this movie, by the way. We're still in Act One.
We have not even gotten to the Act One turn yet.
I love this. I think we're going to start doing this for every movie because this is fun. So wouldn't you know it, the stripper ends up getting murdered outside of the club. She tells Damon Wayans, hey, I've got your birthday present. Let's go back to my place. Bruce Willis is following her to protect her, but gets waylaid by these random hitmen who decide they're going to murder him. He obviously outsmarts and outfights them. But in that being distracted, Halle Berry gets killed. Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis go to her apartment.
Before we get there.
Okay.
One of my favorite stupid great character moments. This is one of the things that Shane Black is so great at is he just creates these great little very human moments. Like in most scenes where a character is about to be executed, everyone ramps up the tension. You know, it's all about when they're going to pull the trigger or not. He's on his knees. It's dark. It's grim. And instead, Shane Black makes it super human.
Yeah.
And, you know, Hollenbeck is just cool as fuck. Like, he's just got ice water running through his veins. And as you'll find out why...
He's Val Kilmer from Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He's got that same kind of mentality under fire, which is just
even,
like...
Even more than that, like, this is... I don't think Shane Black has written a character with this much ice water in his veins in the entire... Because, and the thing is, he's a character who used to be in the Secret Service. He's one of those guys who stands there and will stare at you, watching the entire crowd out of the corner of his eye for a gun, and will never show his emotion because that is his fucking job. And this is who this guy is. And so this guy's being marched to his death, and he's thinking about 30 different things, ways to get out of this, but he's just not seeing the right one yet. So he's playing it cool. He's playing it calm. And what does he do? He starts telling jokes.
Yeah.
And you get to this moment where he's like telling this hitman that he fucked his wife the night before. And then
he goes into Carson mode.
And he starts telling fat jokes. And he goes, ask me how fat she is. And the guy's just holding the gun to him.
And he can't help it.
He can't help himself. He's like, all right, I'm about to blow your head off. I got to hear this. How fat is she?
She is so fat. You slap her thigh and you ride the wave.
Yeah, it's great. And it's this moment where, like, this guy, like, he even says, look, man, this is just business. It's nothing personal. Like, this guy's not angry at this guy. He can't wait to kill this guy. He's just been told to kill him. And the guy wants to tell jokes. So he's like, fuck it. I'll let you tell a joke. This guy has no idea what he's gotten himself into, has no idea that this guy's a real threat. And this is the first moment we realize how big a threat Hollenbeck is. Up until this point in the movie, Hollenbeck is just a fuck up. Once this happens, we realize A, how fucking smart he is, and B, how fucking fast and badass he is.
Yeah.
Like, when he grabs the gun and fucking, he grabs the gun and pushes it away at the same time he grabs a bottle nearby, smashes it on the ground, and drives it into the guy's fucking neck.
By the way, is this, now that you've brought that up, is this the most violent Shane Black's script turned into a movie that we've ever seen? Because the only, like, I thought all the way back to Lethal Weapon, I couldn't think of anything as cumulatively violent. The only movie I couldn't quite remember every scene of was Long Kiss Goodnight.
Long Kiss Goodnight is much more violent.
Really?
Oh, yeah. And Long Kiss Goodnight is creepy in concept.
Well, I mean, yeah, no, it's creepy. I just mean,
no,
like,
no. I mean, violence wise, oh, she's unreal. Like, the violent shit that she does, that Gina Davis does in that film, Gina Davis, right?
Yeah, she. Yeah.
Is unreal. Like, she is a programmed assassin.
Just for my own edification, did you run through your mental Rolodex of Gina Gershon, Gina Rollins, Gina Davis, Gina?
No. I was just like, the name. The name actually came to me. How often does the name actually come to me? Like, the name. You know.
What's hilarious is that you usually have to stop and go, oh, what's the name? What the fuck? But you got it right away. So instead, I stopped the show to ask why you didn't stop the show.
Yeah, why I didn't stop the show.
And the serpent eats its own tail, and we're back.
Circling
back, folks.
Yeah, no, but yeah, that movie's much more violent, and that movie has that whole creepy thing where it's essentially blowing up a bridge to kill 3,000 people to get America to go to war, and an act of terror. And you watch that movie post 9/11, and it's just like, oh, this movie. Wow, Shane.
Yeah.
Wow. Way to be 7 years early on that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because there is some prescient shit in this. And do not let me forget to talk about that once we get a little further into this plot, which is that. So Jimmy and Bruce Willis's character, whose name I keep...
Joe Hollenbeck.
I keep wanting to call Bruce Willis Jimmy, because he's in another movie where his name is Jimmy.
No, Joe Hollenbeck, and that's a name I remember very well, because that was one of the...
Jimmy Tulip.
That was one of the first writers for Ain't It Cool News.
Okay.
And he had taken... Because he started a bunch of the early Ain't It Cool News people took their characters from their favorite movies, and yeah. Joe Hollenbeck happened to be a huge fan of this film, and so I was used for years, whenever I'd hear Joe Hollenbeck, like, when I'd watch this movie, I'd be like, oh yeah, the writer from Ain't It Cool News, and it's like, yeah, this is where he got it.
I'm pretty sure that way back in the day, before I even moved to Austin, the first thing I ever got published might have been on Ain't It Cool News under the pseudonym War Chief Swan, which is of course a reference to the Warriors. That is deep cut B-side inside baseball Brian trivia that no one needs to know. So they go to investigate Corey's apartment, and they find this tape and a picture of the L.A. Stallions owner and this Senator Calvin Baynard, who is not only the person that I believe that Bruce Willis used to protect.
Oh, he is.
He's the person that Bruce Willis... I got a little confused by that, because
he's the guy who got Bruce Willis fired from from the Secret Service.
Apparently, but he was the president at the time.
No.
Okay, because in the original script, which is something I was reading about, he was the president. So I think that's where I was getting confused, is because I thought when Bruce Willis was protecting him, he was the president, and then when he retired, he went back to being a senator. It was confusing, but that's because I was getting the script and the movie confused in my head. But anyway, so Senator Calvin Boehnert and Shelley Marcone, who's the owner of the LA Stallions, there's this cassette tape and a conversation between the two of them where basically Senator Boehnert is investigating the idea of legalizing gambling in the NFL. And Shelley Marcone is trying to buy his vote, because if it's a Shane Black movie, this is the thing I noticed about Shane Black movies watching this that carries through to every one of his films. You cannot trust rich people ever.
No.
In a Shane Black movie.
No.
You absolutely. That's the reason, by the way, that they have to blow up Tony Stark's house in the first act of Iron Man 3, because the Tony Stark at the beginning of Iron Man 3 is the bad guy in every other Shane Black movie.
Yeah.
He's the guy with all the money and all the power who's going to fuck things up for everybody else.
Well,
so they have to humble him. They have to take away all of his wealth, send him to Kentucky and work with a precocious little kid. Like, all the pieces started falling into place when I was watching this movie and thinking about Iron Man 3. Like, that's why they have to blow up Tony Stark's house, because rich people are the devil, according to Shane Black.
So, and there's a reason for this. Let's go back in the conversation a bit and talk about how Shane sold his first script in the mid-80s when he was in his early 20s. I believe he was still in college when he sold the script at USC. And he sold this and instantly became the hot screenwriter. And he sold so many scripts before the time he was 30. And he was part of that late 80s, early 90s LA scene when coke and drugs were still all the fucking rage.
Yeah.
It's still, you know, drugs are still very prevalent in the LA scene today. Don't get me wrong, but at this point, everybody was still at that point where it's like, it's still okay. Like, there's not a problem with it. Like, I can handle my shit. There's no big thing. It wasn't something that was hidden and only came out at parties. It was, you know, you had major directors, you know, doing coke, you know, in front of lots of people.
Like, one of them, probably Joel Silver.
It was a crazy, crazy time in which all this fucked up stuff happened, and Shane got a front row seat. And Shane drew a lot from what was going on around him. I mean, you just look at the stuff that he does, and he takes the genre that he loves, and then he, you know, like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is all about his situation, you know, in LA and dealing with that LA lifestyle and how crazy and absurd it is. Like, that, you know, there's several jokes in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang about dealing with LA women, which are all about his, you know, they're all private in jokes about his dating life.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, that line about, if you take America and turn it on its side and
if you grab it by the East Coast and shake it like a blanket, all the normal girls held on and all the crazy girls ended up in California.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's his commentary on his dating life.
Yeah.
At the time.
I just imagine him going into meetings with Joel Silver as a young kid and just something, an exchange like this happening where they're in the middle of a conversation and Joel Silver's like, just hold on a second.
Davey! We still got fish in the aquarium? Yeah, flush the fish. Fill the aquarium with coke.
Okay, what were you saying? What is this? It's about two cops, one's white, one's black. I love it. Let's buy it. Let's do it now. Like, I just imagine that conversation.
It's about a private detective and an NFL guy, and one guy's white and one guy's black.
One of them's suicidal.
Okay,
and he thinks he's one of the three Stooges.
One of them's a down his luck private detective, and one is a programmed assassin sleeper, and one is white and one is black. That's great.
Okay. So this Lethal Weapon movie, I got this girlfriend, great tits. Not a good actress. Great tits. Is there a part for her? Hey, Shane. Is there a part for her in your movie? Again. Great tits. Great tits, Shane. And that's pretty
much. This episode brought to you by Joel Silver.
This episode brought to you by the word allegedly. Allegedly keeping Junk Food Cinema from being sued. Anywho.
Allegedly from being allegedly sued.
Being allegedly sued. Anyway, so the two of them are investigating. They run afoul of a couple more hitmen as they're trying to investigate. Bruce Willis stops Marlon Wayans from also being blown up in a car bomb, but they get arrested. And at the police station, it's revealed that Joe used to be a Secret Service member for this senator and was fired because he basically barged in while the senator was abusing a prostitute and punched him in the face. And because he wasn't willing to cover up the sex scandal, was fired and basically disgraced and run out of the game, and that gives us the backstory for our character.
And what you also then find out shortly after is that he was on this detail while resting after being shot saving President Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
By the way, this movie is so old.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. He saved Jimmy Carter's life.
That's where the president came into it. That's what was confusing me. Okay, that makes sense.
He saved Jimmy Carter's life.
But the senator, not Jimmy Carter, the senator is played by Chelsea Ross.
Yes.
Who I will forever remember as Conrad Hilton from Mad Men, but has been in a shit ton of stuff.
Oh, yes.
This movie is lousy with character actors, by the way. The entire goon squad that eventually gets sent after Bruce Willis is Taylor Negron.
Yeah.
It is. Oh my God. What is his name? He's got a girl's.
What, Cargill? What's going on over there?
It's happening to me right now. Kim Coates. Kim Coates.
You've been infected.
Luckily,
I have passed on the curse.
Luckily, I have this injection of IMDb that I can shoot into my system. Kim Coates, who is also the coach from Goon, who says things like, "You want to know why we lose? Because you're fucking shit." I love Kim Coates. He's amazing.
Oh, he's great.
And then, of course, the other thug in that scene is Frank Collison, who is another just incredible character actor who you probably don't know his name, but if you see his very odd face, you will absolutely recognize this guy.
Yeah.
He was in movies like, probably one of the best examples for this particular show would be, he's the guy who's weirdly insistent upon hot dogs in The Happening. Like, yeah. He's just that guy. He's just got that really odd looking face. But so they send a trio of them.
The Happening, by the way, a movie we will never cover.
No, because I think I wrote the definitive article about The Happening when this.
Oh, did you?
I wrote it where basically.
The definitive article?
I think, dude, I don't mind saying it. I wrote an article where I encourage people to play The Happening. Turn off the TV and just listen to it, because it works 1,000 times better as a radio play than it does as a movie, because everyone is over-explaining everything that happens in that movie so much that it's awkward to watch.
Well, how do you make a movie about where you're running from grass that you don't?
You have your character say, "Oh my God, here it comes," and leave it to the audience's imagination, because when you show them grass slowly moving left and right as your actual villain, you look like an insane person and not a major studio director. Anywho... Moving on, so in the plot here...
In a far superior film.
Jumping back on the rails that lead us to this discussion, where were we? Oh, yes, so this all comes out about Joe's backstory, and the two of them decide to work together, because the other heartbreaking thing about this is that Jimmy realizes that Halle Berry was blackmailing this senator and this team owner, not for money, but to get him his job back, to get him reinstated in the league.
Yeah, that she
and that's
ended
why
up
she's
getting
dead.
Killed to try to give him the best gift possible.
Which adds a lot more heart to sports than I think a lot of sports movies pull off sometimes.
And here's where the movie is super fucking interesting. Again, another brilliant Shane Black concept.
There's
something...
another beer bug in here. It sounds like people are opening beers. It's just a bug.
I know, it's weird.
It's a Texas cricket that a lot of people don't know about. We call them beer bugs.
Yeah, they tend to hover around fridges filled with Lone Star, which is here in your house for some reason. Mm-hmm. I don't know why you said when I came in, "Hey, we've got lots of extra Lone Star in the fridge. Drink it."
National Beer of Texas, ladies and gentlemen.
So, yeah, no, but...
Not paying for this show, by the way.
Not brought to you by Lone Star.
Not brought to you by Lone Star, because we don't know how advertising works.
So, yeah, but the concept here is our characters are given everything they need to fuck over the bad guys. Everything.
In Act 1!
No. It's after the Act 1 turn, but it's in the first part of Act 2.
No, they're given the tape in Act 1.
Yeah, they haven't listened to it until the shit goes down.
And what happens as soon as they fucking listen to it?
It gets destroyed.
Here, let me hit fast forward. No, fast forward eats the tape, God damn it!
Fast forward eats the tape!
You had everything you needed. Everything you needed to put these guys away.
And so now these guys know what's up, but they can't prove it.
But see, in any other movie, and this is why I love Shane Black, in any other movie... This kind of thing would be brought about by the bad guys. They would have destroyed the tape. They would have stolen it, whatever. No, the incompetence of these two, because they're not real cops and don't really know what they're doing, that's what handcuffs them. And I'm using that pun absolutely intentionally.
Yeah.
They handcuff themselves.
No, it's absolutely fascinating to watch how they fuck themselves out of everything they need to get the killer. And they drop the ball, so to speak.
Hey-o.
Hey-o. and then get dragged along on a nonstop action spree that, with only moments of catching your breath, are the characters actually bonding and learning how fucked up each of their lives are.
Yeah. And I love that so much of this movie is this formula of, like, investigate for a minute, get caught by somebody. Investigate for a minute, get caught by... Because they're so bad at this together that they just keep getting caught, and it keeps being up to like, these basic... these MacGyver techniques that they're able to get out of all these scenarios. And usually you see that once or twice in a movie like this. This movie, it's, like, pretty much every 20 minutes you can count on, oh, no, they've got us pinned down with a gun. Here's Bruce Willis to set off the C4 in the trunk. Or here's Damon Wayans to throw a bullet into a fire and cause an explosion that sets a man on fire. I love it. I love that scene. So... They are investigating this. They lose the evidence. I'm trying to remember where we are in the story here. So Joe takes Jimmy back to his house, where we meet his daughter, Darian, played by...
Danielle Harris.
The adorable Danielle Harris.
The one of the great crushes of my life.
A Junk Food Cinema alum, yeah. In fact, because she is the star of Halloween 4 and Halloween 5.
Yeah. No. And
one of those movies is worth watching.
Yeah, she is, I think... 2 years younger than me at most.
She's not listening to this, and this is not tender, so I don't think you have to
sell yourself. No. My thing is no, it's weird. No, she's like literally when I was a young movie nerd, especially a young horror nerd, you know, we're roughly the same age, and I had a big crush on her. And you know, she was one of my big movie crushes. Actually ran into her a few years ago at a horror convention. I was helping out a friend who was a guest at a horror convention, and I was essentially her body man. And we walk into the bar, and there's Danielle Harris, and I'm like, oh my God, it's Danielle Harris. And she's like, well, go up and talk to her. And I was like, I can't do that. I can't. What am I going to say? Like, of all the people I've met, I meet Danielle Harris in a bar in Houston, Texas.
Sure.
And can't say a fucking word. I just can't, because it's fucking Danielle Harris. And oh my God. So
the story is so nice. Cargill told it twice. To hear it the first time, visit our episode on Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers.
Oh, did I? I completely forgot I told that story.
It's okay. I wasn't going to steal your thunder.
This is beer number 4, asshole.
Yes. Yes. Collectively, I think we've killed a 12-pack, but
we're getting there.
We're getting there. So everything's going smoothly, and then this is where Damon Wayans' character has a really heartfelt, almost Phoebe Catesian type, like, heartbreaking story about how he was.
I like how I know. I love how you went there. I know exactly. You're going full Gremlins on me.
He's going a little Gremlins on us. Where he tells the story of he was playing a football game in Tampa Bay, and his wife was 8 months pregnant, and she was taking a walk at their home in L.A., and a car jumped the curb and killed her. And his infant son lived for, I think,
17 minutes
in an incubator and died as well. And
just he slipped into sleep, just enough time for one dream.
One dream.
Oh my God, Shane, Jesus!
And then
depressing.
Danielle Harris comes out and tells him to stop being such a fucking pussy, which she would have, because she is the most. Here's another great thing about Shane Black movies: foul mouthed, awesome kids.
Oh God! And this character, Danielle Harris in this movie is only rivaled by teenage Negasonic Warhead from Deadpool.
Nice.
Like, that is who this is. Like, she is that really smart teenage girl who has a very weird interaction with adult that is not a natural interaction, but is not unnatural.
Yeah.
And is acknowledged. Like, she's very much an early teenager, but her dad is such a fuck up that she can get away with, like, mouthing off to him. And like, it's so heartbreaking when it's like, you're such a fuck up. Where do you learn language like that, huh? What, I can't call you a fuck up? Mom calls you a fuck up all the time. It's like, oh my God.
There's a deleted scene of Monster Squad I want to see where they try to tell her she can't be in, and she just fucking goes to town on those dudes. Like, I would love to see the Monster Squad try and tell her she can't be a member. That would be... Because, again... Yeah. All the kids in Monster Squad, Danielle Harris in this movie, to a certain extent, the little girl in the Nice Guys. Like, this Shane Black, I think it's so much of his personal experience is, you know, bleeds onto the page. And I feel like Little kid in Iron Man 3, absolutely. In fact, the little kid in Iron Man 3 has a very brief cameo in the Nice Guys.
Nice.
Where it's like, yeah, and I feel like Shane Black was probably a foul-mouthed, sarcastic little dick of a kid, and just that's what he writes.
He had to be,
right? He absolutely fucking had to be.
Yeah.
So what? But the other thing that comes about in this interaction at the house is that Damon Wayans starts to take these painkillers. Bruce Willis gets really pissed off, punches him, and throws
him. No, he's not at that point. He's like snorting fucking coke. Like, okay. He's got a big bag of coke.
But he's got coke. He's also got a bag of pills. I think either IMDb or Wikipedia says it's painkillers. But he's using.
Well, drugs. No, he was addicted to painkillers, and then he talks about how you move on from painkillers.
So he's using drugs. Bruce Willis throws him out of the house, and this interesting turn where Danielle Harris is waiting outside, saying, "Literally, I'm sorry, I was such a bitch."
She's waiting there. Hey, will you sign my baseball card?
Will you sign
or my football card?
This football card, because my dad was your biggest fan and stopped watching football after you were thrown out of the league. So it's this, which the only thing that is weird about that for me is Damon Wayans looks so fucking young in this movie that it's hard for me to believe that he had a career that was long enough that, you know, Bruce Willis could have been a big fan of his and then like been so disillusioned.
Well, but he was, as they said, he was the star of the league 2 years in a row. And
yeah.
So,
but which 2 years? Cause it seems like, and this is just something about Damon Wayans in general. I have trouble believing that Damon Wayans has a son old enough to be on New Girl who's that age.
Well, he's always been a young.
He's very baby-faced. Yeah. Very baby-faced guy.
But this moment right here is what I was talking about at the beginning of the episode, where what this is this entire relationship between these two guys is about the disenfranchisement of America from baseball.
Yeah.
Where that
which now you can extrapolate to all sports, and I think it works even better now as a metaphor for what's going on in the NFL.
Yeah.
And I'm still not, there's one more element I need
And you know what? I would argue that it's very much the relationship with people in ESPN now.
Sure. No,
just that whole notion of what ESPN has become in selling sports and how that's kind of turned people off.
Well, the prescient thing about this is that the bad guy of Shelley, who's the owner of the LA.
Shelley Marcone,
who's the owner of the LA Stallions, could be Roger Goodell. And the whole thing about we're trying to legalize gambling and we're willing to kill and do all this is like, look at what's going on with this FanDuel stuff and these like single day fantasy football betting sites. Like,
oh, yeah.
All of a sudden, this movie becomes totally like headline news relevant.
Oh, yeah. And now where we've got, you know, we've got NFL players who are murdering fucking people. And,
yeah. And yeah. And there's a cop says in this movie, like, free agency is killing the game. And it's like, I mean, free agency is now like the least of the league's problems.
Yeah. But at the time,
that was killing that was what was considered to be killing the integrity of the game. Yeah. So for different reasons, but this movie becomes to the forefront of consciousness again. And I think that's amazing. Like, this movie holds up in so many ways. And then on top of that, the message of this movie, which I think you're absolutely right, was intended to be an analog for Major League Baseball, suddenly becomes relevant for what's going on right now in the NFL.
Yeah.
And it's freaky the way that works out. So they have that whole interaction, and he signs the card to the daughter of the last Boy Scout, yeah, which is the blink and you'll miss it moment where kind of bringing things full circle. So the next morning, the cops find out about, because, by the way, when Mike's car blew up, Bruce Willis didn't tell them that he was there to fuck his wife. He told him he was there to give him this case. They find out from a neighbor that the car had been there all the night. They deduce that he'd been fucking Joe's wife, and they decide, Joe must have killed him. And on top of that, Joe gets abducted by Taylor Negron, and he shoots a cop that shows up to
Taylor Negron shoots the cop
who was there to arrest Joe
with
Joe's
again,
gun.
Classic fucking Shane Black snappy
is
dialogue.
There a problem here?
Yes,
officer.
This bullet has too many guns. This gun has too many bullets.
Dear God, this parachute is a knapsack. This gun has too many bullets in
stop
it.
Stop with the Friends references. That's your second.
Shoot. The third. It's Taylor Negron.
The third
Taylor
Friends
Negron
reference.
Taylor Negron is the chef that gives Monica the job at Alessandro's,
yes,
because
and,
he thinks that he's from
third,
Lebanon and
yes,
he thinks he knows how to make marinara sauce.
The third Friends reference in this episode shuts the episode down.
There's so many Friends references I want to make.
I know.
Couldn't even see that one. So the next morning, like I said, Taylor Negron kidnaps Joe, kills the cop with Joe's gun. So they decide that instead of paying the senator the $6 million that he wants for his vote, they're just going to kill him. And the way they're going to do it is they're going to photograph Joe making the handoff of this briefcase to the senator's man. But wouldn't you know it, the briefcase was switched at the last minute. It doesn't contain money. It contains a bomb. So they're going to keep the $6 million. They're just going to blow up the senator, and they're going to get the votes anyway. Kind of a brilliant plan, actually. Except that I'm like, well, the guys, in order for this plan to work, those guys need to not look in the briefcase. So they have this like elaborate carnival contraption in the back of their limousine where the briefcase literally spins around on this Lazy Susan and turns into a different briefcase. And I'm like, well, if the whole point was that those guys couldn't look in the briefcase because there's a bomb in it, why did you need two briefcases?
Because they open the briefcase beforehand.
Do they?
Yeah, and they show the money.
That's my bad.
And then that's where Taylor Negron is, whoa. Did any of you guys frisk this guy? He could be a cop. And then they spin him around. They spin it, and then...
Blink and you'll miss it, bro.
You'll miss it.
So that's going on, and so this become they escape from the clutches of Taylor Negron and the other guys because... And this is the great thing I love about this movie is that all of a sudden when Joe is kidnapped, it falls upon Damon Wayans and Danielle Harris to be the detectives, two people who are about as far from being detectives as you could possibly get. But they're able to kind of follow in the footsteps and, you know, follow the clues and get there. Of course, they're immediately, Damon Wayans is immediately captured by the guys. But Danielle Harris comes up with this puppet and is like, oh, and they're like, oh, this kid's here. And she's like, hey, mister, make this puppet talk. Hands it to her dad. There's a gun inside the puppet, wouldn't you know it? Lots of action ensues. They chase them, by the way. I don't know if you noticed this, that causeway and that bridge where they have that chase and then they kind of jump down into that moss. I'm like, that's the exact same fucking bridge where Robert Downey Jr. like falls across the coffin and then onto the car in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He even falls, Moynihan even falls into that same patch of moss at the end of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I thought that was really interesting.
Well, here's what's very interesting about that in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. The third act of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, one of the brilliant things about Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is about how it starts as a very real story and by the third act has become a cartoon.
Yeah.
And has become the cliched novel. So of course him going back to the big cliched action movie scene in a movie that he famously has issues with sounds exactly like Shane might have been taking a very private dig and being like, yes, I'm going to set this here because this is where this scene happens in this film that I have bad blood with.
So a car chase happens where they're trying to get this briefcase back before it gets to the senator. They go into the stadium and they are, well, but wouldn't you know it, they manage to get away from Taylor Negron. They think he's dead. They leave Danielle Harris with, by the way, the other neighbor from The Burbs, who's also in a lot of Bill Murray movies, whose name I can't think of right now, is this guy that they take his car and they leave Danielle Harris with him to call the cops. Taylor Negron's not dead. He captures Bruce Willis's daughter, Danielle Harris. So they go to the stadium to try to get her back. Their intention is to kidnap Shelley Marcone and kind of trade them, but they get ambushed there. This is where Marlon Wayans has to use this trick with the special type of bullet that he throws into the fireplace. And all of this basically... to set up the major set piece of the finale of the film, which is that they've decided since the bomb thing didn't work out, they're going to have Taylor Negron just fucking snipe the senator from, you know, the stadium lights. So this sets up this whole action sequence where basically you have Marlon Wayans riding a horse, which is the LA Stallions mascot, across the field. And I'm like, that poor player who gets knocked down is probably going to be out 4 to 6 months at least from a horse injury, which is going to be real hard to explain to the commission. So you have, and probably the most unbelievable moment in the movie, because I feel like it could have been tweaked just a little bit. Marlon Wayans throws a football at the senator, which ends up getting in the path of the bullet. Wouldn't it have just made more? And I feel like this might have been where Joel Silver messed with the script a little bit.
It may have been.
Wouldn't it have made more sense? Because earlier in the movie,
for the football to hit him in the face,
yes,
move him out
so
of the way.
So he just gets out of the way or falls over or something. Yeah. What? All of a sudden he's fucking Hawkeye? Marlon Wayans is riding across the field on a horse like fucking Hawkeye, knowing exactly where the bullet's going to come and like throwing
Hawkeye
the football.
Hawkeye doesn't ride no horse.
I think it's bullshit. And I think this is because earlier in the movie, we see Marlon Wayans throw a football at some guy's face to stop him from like abusing this woman.
Well, and there's several points during the movie where he uses the football. You know, it's the one thing he knows how to do is fucking throw shit.
Yeah, yeah. Which is funny because there's a fucking dude. There's a line of dialogue in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang where Michelle Moynihan compares Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer to how black people are treated in professional sports, which is, oh, don't talk to Reggie, he's black. Oh, but wait, he can throw a football. Now let's make him famous. And it's just like, Wait a minute. Wait, what are Shane Black's actual feelings about the NFL? Because on the one hand, this guy is the fucking hero of the movie, and on the other hand, it's like, It's just funny to me to watch
the thing about Shane Black is that he sees the dark side and the seediness and everything.
Oh,
and
my
That's what's so great about all of his movies.
You're absolutely right. His characters are so hard-boiled, you could dip them in vinegar and hide them for the kids on Easter. It is ridiculous how dark he goes with these people. So, no, I absolutely agree with that. So the big final showdown moment is Taylor Negron and Bruce Willis on this light scaffolding above the stadium. Great fight sequence. We get a John McClane yell out of Bruce Willis as he's swinging down on the fence back into the light when you think he's going to fall. And then Taylor Negron.
And then comes one of the great death scenes.
Holy shit,
of 90s cinema.
I think he gets two deaths in this movie. Three, because we already thought he was dead in the car accident. So this is his third death. The second death is he gets riddled with SWAT team bullets.
Yes.
Riddled with SWAT team bullets.
And you assume he's falling
to his death. He's going
to
fall into the stadium, right?
No.
But here comes his helicopter.
And he falls into the whirling blades of the helicopter and gets Cuisinarted in a way that I was just like, I literally watching, and I've seen this movie before, but revisiting it tonight, I audibly said, Jesus Christ, Last Boy Scout.
Yeah, it's kind
you
of
murdered the
it's kind of a
Taylor Negron.
It's his fucking death.
And that was the moment I was like, maybe this is, it is at least one of the top three most violent Shane Black scripts.
Violent deaths.
No, but the whole movie, like, people are getting fucking shot in the knees, but the guys get
blown
set on,
up,
like, when you throw a bullet into a fireplace, you think maybe the explosion will just cause a distraction and people will get shot. A guy gets set on fucking fire and burns to death.
Well, because they're shredders.
They're shredder bullets, so they'll kill all of the bad guys and all the Ninja Turtles, apparently, because they're shredder bullets.
The shredder never actually kills the Ninja
Turtles.
That's true,
he just stands around and lets ninjas
kill turtles. Shredder bullets can kill people, but not turtles.
What they'll do, shredder bullets, is when you fire them, they actually stand still and make a bunch of ninjas fail to kill Ninja Turtles.
And it depends on what Ninja Turtles you're a fan of, because some of us are the comic fans that know that the shredder is made up of just a writhing mound of fucking maggots. The Shredder's awesome.
I'm sorry, you started talking about Laird and Eastman, and I fell asleep a little bit.
Eastman and Laird, get it right.
Anyway, so Shredder bullets will take out a dock, though. You fire one Shredder bullet, for some reason it'll just take a dock out and destroy itself. Not the point. So this is the end of the movie. We get our Lord of the Rings multiple endings, where first we see that Bruce Willis goes up to that same senator who is like, you probably orchestrated this whole thing. And of course he goes, so it gives him the same choice that he gave to Mike, which
head
or gut.
And he goes, what?
And then
Wham!
He hits him in both because he didn't pick one. You got to pick one, guys.
You got to pick one.
He spells it out for you. You got to pick one. And then the second ending is, in the first ending, we see him kind of reconcile with his wife a little bit. And then the second ending is that they decide to form a detective agency together, which we mentioned before. You mentioned being unbelievable, but I will say this about Shane Black, not to spoil anything, happens in three out of the four buddy cop movies I have seen Shane Black do.
Not to spoil anything, but we just went through the literal plot of the whole movie.
Yeah, no. I mean, not to spoil anything for the future, but I'm just saying, three out of the four buddy cop movies I've seen from Shane Black, that is the exact ending of the movie.
Well, yeah, because the notion of his buddy cops are that they're two people who can't get together, that at the end they're like, hey, you know what? We did pretty good.
By the way,
we should hang out.
I know I'm breaking the flow here, but I want to go back for a second to how hard-boiled these characters are. Do you remember
Vinegar again?
Do you remember in Monster Squad how even though that movie's about a bunch of kids fighting monsters, there's still a subplot about the parents going through a nasty divorce?
Yeah.
Shane Black's not afraid of the dark side of anybody.
No. He knows how to connect you to the characters, and he knows that that you connect. What's so great about Shane Black characters is that what is interesting about them isn't how awesome they are. How awesome they are is why you're watching this story. What's interesting about them is how broken they are.
Yes.
And how human they are. And all of his characters have that. I mean, you look at stuff like Long Kiss Goodnight, where, you know, it's a really down on his luck, really fucking shyster of a scam artist detective teamed up with a killer assassin who has no memory. You know, you've got, you know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you've got this really talented detective who's looked down upon because it's the 2000s and it's his sexuality, teamed up with this really shit heel loser. But this loser who just happens to have the information to solve this case. All of his stories are like this. Like, all of these characters have major problems, and that's what makes them interesting, and that's what makes them compelling, and makes these movies so infinitely rewatchable.
Absolutely. And when this all culminates, when all is said and done, you've got a great story where, once again, because of Shane Black, you can't trust rich people. You got a great story that becomes prescient again, was intentionally originally intended to be an analog for the MLB, but becomes prescient in this day and age when you think about the NFL and what it's going through. And you have great characters. You have great action set pieces. This is just a phenomenal movie. You have Michael Kamen doing the score, who did the score for fucking Die Hard. You have Bruce, which makes me think, at some part in the back of my lizard brain was like, you know, maybe this is what John McClane was doing when he first got back to LA, when he decided to be an LA cop, or not back to LA, but when he transferred out to LA after, you know, the whole Nakatomi thing, which, by the way, the Fox Tower is in one of the shots, which is doubled as Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard. But I was like, maybe this is what John McClane did when he moved from New York to LA to be with Holly. Like, the first case he took on was this weird NFL case, because you got Michael Kamen, you got a scene where Daniel Harris is watching Lethal Weapon, and it's specifically the scene where Al Leong is torturing Mel Gibson. And of course, Al Leong is one of the terrorists in Die Hard. So just all these little crossover things. By the way, did you know that Mel Gibson, not only was Mel Gibson offered John McClane, but Bruce Willis was offered Riggs. So it's like this weird, like, crossover thing where, like, they were kind of offered each other's roles. If you could see
both of those,
for the listener at home, if you could see the look on Cargill's face right now, it's pretty priceless.
An alternate reality out there where neither of those movies are quite the same.
Oh my God! When you're talking about Die Hard, there's 50 alternate universes. One of which Frank Sinatra is John McClane. So there's a lot of alternate universe diehards out there. There's an Arnold Schwarzenegger one. There's a Richard Gere one. There's so many alternate, because every fucking person in Hollywood was offered that role before Bruce Willis. That's the hilarious part about it.
And that's the movie that made Bruce Willis.
And it's the movie that made Bruce Willis. But the movie we talked about tonight is Last Boy Scout. And if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you do so. It is.
If you haven't seen it, you just listen to this. We fucking ruined it.
Yeah, we ruined everything for you. We start to finish.
But if you're watching this having watched it, go back and rewatch this movie. Mm-hmm. You will be amazed at just how modern it fucking feels, and yeah, how breathless it is, yes, and how great it is. And you'll notice a lot of stuff that was, you know, the thing about Tony Scott was Tony Scott was an edgy as fuck director. Like, he was always on the cutting edge, and he was always playing around with stuff. And sometimes that's why people would get turned off to him, like stuff that he did in the early 2000s. People are like, oh my God, stop with the editing. And people referred to his movies as having avid farts. And he was always playing around because he didn't want to make something like he'd made before. He didn't want to make something like anyone else is making. And instead, he became one of those guys that everyone else ripped off. You watch this movie, you cannot, there is no Michael Bay without Tony Scott. There is no Fast and Furious without Tony Scott.
This is true.
You know, you look at this movie and you're like, holy shit, this is what movies look like today. Like, there are certain effects where it's like, oh my God, like what Tony Scott was doing with filters, like that sepia filter to give that dirty look was then ripped off by everybody through the 90s and became edgy as hell. And now it looks kind of dated because Tony Scott's the one that dated it, because he's the guy who fucking brought that to the fore. Like, this, he was such a hip, talented fucking motherfucker. And this is one of those greats, one of the movies that he made that are just perfect for what it is. Like, you will be hard pressed to find another buddy cop in quotation marks movie as good as this that doesn't have Shane Black's name on it.
Absolutely true. So be prepared for how good this is.
Hey, life up, bitch.
And that brings us to, of course, the junk food pairing. Now, I wrestled with this one a little bit, Cargo.
Did you?
I did. I considered chocolate chip ice cream, which is the ice cream that
Danielle Harris is her favorite.
Yeah, it's the one that Bruce Willis tries to use as a peace offering that he ends up getting pissed at her and throwing out the window. It's also very cool and full of chunks, as this movie is full of visceral pieces of bad guys. Taylor Negron, R.I.P. I also considered reindeer goat cheese pizza, because Bruce Willis mentions that in this movie and Hudson Hawk the same year inexplicable tie-in between those films, but that seemed far too hoity and far too toity to be considered junk food. So instead I went with Ardbeg Single Malt Scotch. Because okay. Let me tell you something about this movie, about this Tony Scott directed, Shane Black written, Bruce Willis starring, Michael Kamen composed film. It is manly as fuck.
Holy shit.
This movie is manly, it is sharp, and it is so smoky. It is, this whole movie has a perpetual layer of smoke as if it's being lit by a series of hobo
Jesus
fires.
Jesus Christ, we just, you have, after 2 fucking years, we have finally gotten pretentious in our junk food pairings. We are pairing it with a scotch now.
We're pairing it
with a nice smoky scotch.
Because.
With a slight peat to it.
Because this movie looks like it's lit by a series of hobo barrel fires because there's smoke everywhere all the time. And not only that, but this is a movie where you watch it and you understand where Shane Black has been and you understand everything he's done from that point forward. And you understand that this guy gets better with age and you cannot get an Ardbeg single malt scotch less than 10 years old. And in fact, can buy several years more aged Ardbeg scotch because that is the way to fucking drink scotch. So I feel like when you take all of those elements and when you take the fact that you should watch this movie and
scotches are like girls. You never have them when they're under 10.
You ruined it. I had a whole thing going.
I'm sorry. I derailed your train. To be fair.
Allegedly under 10.
Allegedly under 10. To be fair, I try to stick at 18. So. Since we're being pretentious about our...
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Are you going to accuse me of being pretentious as you make jokes about statutory rape? Wait, I'm sorry. Was my joke too pretentious for your statutory rape humor?
You know, sometimes when you go a little lofty, you got to go back down into the gutter.
Wow. Much like the characters in a Shane Black script are always in the gutter when you know for a fact that deep down... They are elevated by a lofty sense of moral. I can't even do this because the fucking 10-year-old thing was too much.
I'm sorry.
I'm done. So scotch. Drink some fucking scotch, asshole.
Drink some fucking scotch. You know what? That's how I watched this movie last night.
What? Watch Last Boy Scout and drink some scotch, you fucking assholes. That's the message I have for you. And thank you for joining us.
I'm sorry. I can't mean to don't be that.
This whole Danielle Harris thing is even creepier now. But join us once again next week for more junk food cinema. By the way, I want to announce, this is a really inopportune but perfect also time to announce, that we will be launching our Patreon account here in the next couple weeks, and so keep an eye out for that. So if you guys like what we do, if you would like to support us, if you would like to help us, because right now, I think Cargill's mentioned this before, we don't make any money doing this. This is purely out of love, and
the fact that we enjoy hanging out in your garage and fucking drinking beer and talking about movies.
And as much as I would still love to do that, living in Austin gets more and more expensive every fucking day, and we are certainly not going to charge you to keep listening to this. That's not what Patreon is. You guys will still be able to download and listen to this show for free every day, every week, but... if you would like to kick in, you know, a few dollars per new episode and help us kind of subsidize all the work that we do on this show, that would be amazing. We'd really appreciate that. And there will be more details as soon as we launch that campaign here in the next couple weeks. So look out for that. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter as well as on Facebook. Twitter, we are at Junk Food Cinema. Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. You can also get our back cataloged episodes on iTunes and on Stitcher. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Find me at Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or on Facebook at facebook.com/massaworm.
All right. You can find me on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury. You can also find my Facebook page, Brian Salisbury Critic, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. And, of course, right here on filmschoolrejects.com. And before we go out, I just want to remind you guys of this crucial piece of advice. Whether you're talking about, whether you're talking about damning pieces of evidence on cassette, or whether you're talking about your copy of Over the Top on VHS, please keep in mind, fast forward eats the tape.
It eats the tape.
It eats the tape.
It eats the tape.